Tales from the Dark Pool is funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee.
Diagwich agus Falchuk at Tales from the Dark Pool. I'm Lana Raymond.
And I'm Sarah Challoner.
And we'll be presenting today's programme.
Lots happening here today, so without further ado,
let's get started.
With a disconcerting story from Skull Katrina,
The Lullaby Child by Fionn McLachlan. It was a cold Saturday afternoon. I was walking up the steps of my friend Joey's house. There were two others there, Hayley and Kim. We all usually hung out on the weekend together. As soon as I was welcomed in, I was called upstairs by Joey. When I got upstairs, I was met by three confused faces. "Take a look at this," he said, handing me his phone. There was a text opened from an anonymous number reading, "Come to Loch Fyne Castle and stay the night. You'll be rewarded in cash." They all looked at me, waiting for a response. "It's probably a hoax," I said, finally. "Some kids playing a prank." "But think of the money promised," Kim chirped. "You're not seriously considering this, are you?" I replied with a laughing tone. 3 hours later, we were walking through the wet fields with backpacks. I had pleaded for us not to go, but all the others could think about was the reward. They had all told their parents that they were staying over at mine, while I nervously told my parents that I was sleeping at Joey's. When we arrived at the gates of what was left of a castle, I begged them once more not to do this, but I gave up and followed them. When I caught up with them, they had already picked a spot for the night. It was just getting dark when we decided to explore. We wandered around the ruins until Hayley noticed the purple glow coming from the end of a passage. The closer we got, the more we heard a soft voice singing a lullaby of some kind. Convinced it was haunted, me, Hayley, and Joey stayed where we were, unlike Kim, who kept moving forward, silent, like she was under a spell. After she disappeared into the room, we heard a shriek and fall to the ground. All three of us suddenly ran in after her to be scared out of our wits. In the corner was a baby doll with glowing purple eyes. The singing had stopped. What scared us most was on the phone laying in front of her. It read, "Come to Loch Fyne Castle and stay the night. You'll be rewarded with cash." It had been sent just 4 hours ago, just when Joey had received his. We all ran this time, the girls screaming all the way to the main road, where we made a promise to never speak to anyone about that day. We all went back to our homes, telling our parents that one of the others had gotten very sick. We all lay in bed that night, petrified.
We're heading to St. Aidan's CBS for this thrilling detective romp.
The Unforgiven Past by Kyle Solis. Sophia Robbins, a courageous individual with an enthusiastic and modest personality, who is renowned for intelligence and compassion for her job as an acclaimed detective, using her skills to seek justice for all by working with the prestigious Oakfield Police Department. But her life changes on one unfortunate day when the past resurfaces. Once again, Detective Sophia Robbins closes another case, her colleagues showering her in praises. However, the celebration is abruptly interrupted as soon as the midday news is broadcasted. The whole department freezes in shock as soon as they listen and read the prominent headline, "James Donnelly, the jewelry thief, has reappeared, causing havoc, terrorizing the residents of the tranquil town of Oakfield." As the broadcast ends, Sophia immediately leaves the room and sprints to her office at a quickened pace in anger. She approaches her desk and pulls out a case file, slamming the drawer shut and slapping the file on the dim-lit desk. Reading the bold writing, "James Donnelly," and reading the prominent red block letters, "Unsolved," on the front. To date, this is the only case where Sophia could not conclude the case to a close due to a lack of evidence not viable enough to support her accusations against Mr. Donnelly. But now that the suspect has reappeared after all these years of hibernating, Detective Sophia Robbins can now redeem herself by ending this once and for all. However, she will have to be swift and take a cunning approach before he escapes once again. She looks at the case file for a brief moment, and with determination in her eyes, she begins her endeavor and convenes her former team, which consists of two people, Daniel and Roosevelt Parker. Without delay, she arrives at the crime scene, located in Oakfield Estate, that houses many famous and wealthy individuals. Prepared, ready, and determined, together they begin to analyze the scene meticulously, recording, archiving, and examining every single thing, no matter how big or small. Upon further investigation, the team discovered a rose vase and jewelry stolen from the victim, which is the suspect's signature move that he applies to every crime scene that he has operated in. After gathering everything they required, the team returns back to the police department, where they begin to scrutinize the evidence, piecing it together and trying to find new connections while refining former ones. It's like he knows our moves before he make them. He is able to manage to do this all without leaving a trace of his existence. It's like he wasn't there to begin with, Sophia exclaimed. As soon as saying this, Roosevelt Parker, Sophia's colleague, starts to become nervous and begins to perspire beads of sweat while simultaneously shaking uncontrollably. Before Sophia could ask if he is alright, Roosevelt unexpectedly leaves the room in a rushed and peculiar fashion. With concern, Sophia follows him to his office, and upon approaching it, she hears him ranting to himself, and immediately stops in her tracks. When she hears Roosevelt asking himself, "Does she know I'm James Donnelly?" Sophia barges in and yells to the top of her lungs, "You're under arrest for multiple accounts of theft." He turns slowly, "So you figured out how I evaded the very department that tried to capture me?" he states maliciously, but before he could escape, the commotion attracted a few officers working the night shift. Realizing that he had no chance of escaping, Mr. Donnelly submits to an arrest. Sophia comes from behind and places the handcuffs on him, and ushers him to a cell where he is to wait for his trial.
Perhaps we should dip into our pool of poems at this stage of the proceedings. This poem addresses an age-old topic. Sorry, a sonnet, by Milo O'Rourke. Sorry means nothing when the matter gets serious. The cup is smashed, the shoes are wet. The person you once knew now seems mysterious. You wish they would just forget. How come you never make mistakes? You're never asking to be forgiven. The only thing I can think about is our broken friendship. I get an urge to change our circumstances. I'm driven, but remember you won't accept anything from my lips. What would, what could, what will and won't, my head is full of regret. What if I encounter you round the corner? I pray I don't, for now I wish we'd never met. I wish with all my heart you could see that sorry means nothing to you, but a lot to me.
Good work. We're going to the Donahue's Community School next.
I was gonna do it no matter what, by Lee Forrester. I was going to do it no matter what. I was going to leap and take my shot. When you have a talent, it can help you go far. But if you don't take a risk, you'll never be a star. There's a whole world out there with so much to do. Just follow your heart and make sure your dreams come true. You've got determination and hard work. It's all on your side. You finally made it. So sit back and enjoy the ride.
Art School LaSalle is next, with a very contemplative story by Dara Collins.
Him and Her. As he opened the sitting room door late that night, he saw her sitting on the couch, distracted by the bright screen, responsible for the quiet and unpredictable clicking noise. Her aging face was illuminated in the bright white light of the screen, while her body had a warm orange glow, a result of the old orange tinted bulbs in the lamp he had burnt his delicate fingers on as a child. Right now, the dim room, which used to harbor feelings of nostalgia and warmth, felt cold, dead, and lonely. She looked up at him, her eyes visibly tired from the stress of work, and simply nodded, acknowledging his existence. His nerves tingled right from his head, with his long locks, down to his pinky toes, that had been banged off nearly every piece of furniture in the room. He let out a sheepish smile and looked at the mirror on the wall, froze and saw his reflection, expecting to see a nervous wreck of sweat and shaky limbs, but saw instead his usual self, and realized that all his worrying hadn't managed to affect his appearance. This lack of expression is something he came to learn he should try and avoid, as he learned his emotions should not be bottled up or feared. Seeing that his body was calm, he regained the ability to move and managed to sit himself next to her. Her presence that had calmed him so much now felt like a weight pushing him further into nervousness and fear. He feared he would lose the presence of comfort, and within that minuscule slip into fear, it latched onto him. It grabbed a hold of his mind and started to force feed him dark thoughts, nightmares he knew after the experience wouldn't come true. But in that moment of fear, all of these what-ifs and maybes seemed like whens. "She'll never talk to you again," the fear would say. "She'll throw you out," the nervousness would whisper. "And you're going to tear everyone you love away from yourself," worry yelled. Throughout his inner fear, all he did was sit bolt upright, staring at the screen with her. Only when he realized his knee was shaking so violently did his body manage to throw him back to reality. He worried she'd realize he was uneasy, and so attempted to play it all off by scratching his knee, as if it was nothing more than an odd way to scratch an itch. He truly loved her, and was scared that the love she had for him since he was born would be murdered by the words he knew he'd need to utter at some stage. He started to question why it had to be now, but in his heart, he knew that this was something she deserved to know. He had told others, and it seemed only logical and fair to tell her, since she had accepted every little difference from normality within him. He knew that this could go one way or another, and in that moment, he pushed fear back with relentless optimism and hope, vowed to never feel that way again, and decided, it's time. Turning to her, he stuttered and stammered, sweated and shook, and as she turned to see him as a babbling and blubbering mess, they met eyes, and he let it all out. He let out his denial, his fear, his worry, his heart, and even his tears. He told her after so long of knowing in his heart, mind and soul, that his body may say him, but his heart was truly saying, no, screaming, no, yelling at the top of its lungs, her. And after that moment, the bond between them was cemented in that moment of acceptance and love forever.
The headline said by Emily Lawler. The headline said she was missing. The whole town was eerie and quiet that day. The nosy neighbours didn't even go out of their house. Nobody knew what to say to the Morgans. What could you say? Sorry for your loss? Was she dead or alive? You just couldn't say anything really. All he could do is have hope. It's now been a week since she went missing. All around town had signs printed and hung on every lamppost and newsagent window saying, have you seen this girl? Rose Morgan, 16, 5'7", short blonde hair with a blue streak, blue eyes, brown glasses, wearing a grey jumper and blue jeans. At the end of it, her parents wrote, please come home. Seeing these posters every day, it's almost like I don't even notice them anymore, but I'd never admit that. I was never really a friend of Rose. We hung out before in a group. She told me once my eyeshadow was nice, and that was the only conversation you could call we had. I guess me being 2 years older was a factor too. One day I'm back in school. Rose didn't attend my school, but we all knew. It's a small town. The day just dragged in. I wasn't concentrating the whole day. What was wrong with me? The only thing that I somehow enjoyed was lunch with my friends. It makes you value having them, but then they start annoying you again. After school, my parents took us out for dinner. It was my favourite Italian restaurant. I got pepperoni pizza. I know, basic. But me and my mom got into a deep conversation over politics. Sometimes we can be so different and think differently towards certain topics. My little brother was only 9, so I didn't really expect him to join in on the conversation. Then, after weeks of not seeing them, there they are, trying to act normal and living their lives. Everything almost felt normal except for the cloud over us all. Slowly but surely, things in life were starting to move again. Seeing the Morgans more often, doing everything they could to spread the word about Rose, with the help of the town holding fundraisers for her. Months and months go by, no news, nothing found, but we were still trying. We weren't going to give up. I was planning to go over to the Morgans for new ideas and see how they were. I brought over lasagna for them as a kind gesture, but when I drove up, police and ambulances were all over the house. Was Rose found? The headline said, married couple found dead in home. They were finally home with Rose.
Back to our poems now, and we're off to the cinema with this offering. Inside the Cinema by Maria Simonova. Popcorn machines and colourful walls, chocolate and jellies and sweet scents, children screeching, trailers on screens, people of all ages waiting in line. Inside, people are being seated, some noisy, some quiet, the excitement begins. During the movie, everything goes quiet, lights go out, dimming the room, and only whispers are heard, laughter and crying throughout the movie, smiles and happiness as people begin to leave.
Back to the task in hand. This poem's from Maryfield College.
Her Last by Victoria Stokowit. He intended to be her last, traveled the world, Rome, Paris, Tokyo. She accepted the demons of his past. Their love was forbidden, Juliet to his Romeo. So he covered their connection with hostility and revulsion. She was scared of herself and darkest desires. She couldn't resist his magic compulsion. His heart cold as ice, where her burns like fire. However long it takes is what he declared. In a year or even a century, he would wait. She wanted to give in, but she was too scared. They weren't meant to be. I could call it fate. He set her free to be everything she could be. He told himself every day, I know she'll return to me.
A paradox. I don't know why I'm writing. I'm just sort of writing for the sake of writing. It doesn't really make sense. It has no meaning, no purpose, no reason. It just sort of is. But in this writing, a paradox is formed, a meaning of which to not exist. A purpose involved to have none at all. A reason to have you thinking on, for it has never been here nor gone.
We're going to catch up on our stories now, so relax for A Guide to Staying Calm.
A Guide to Staying Calm by Fionn Munnelly. I sit at my designated desk and patiently await death. Unfortunately, death fails to make an appearance, and my suffering continues in fragile silence. The exam hall is vast and cool, but I am assaulted by my own personal heatwave. Wave after wave of flustered panic and frustration, accompanied by a little bead of sweat snaking its way down my forehead. I offer a blank stare at the sheet of paper before me. It stares back, blank. The clock on the wall continues its merciless ticking. Tick-tock. The exam is English Paper 1, the question personal writing, an enemy of mine since time immemorial. The deafening ticking of the clock and the muffled tapping of inspired pens steadily chip away at what is left of my resolve. Everyone around me is enthralled in their own creative flows. My envy is palpable. Tick-tock. I turn my attention back to the evil page and the wobbly wooden desk beneath me, and the 7 useless creative prompts that it prefers as a gospel. I have been in this situation countless times before, both at home and under the smothering atmosphere of exams. I have always struggled with personal writing. After several disastrous attempts to write personal essays and short stories, I came to the conclusion that at some point in my life I was cursed, whether by the SEC or some malicious spirit I'm not entirely certain. But is it really reasonable to ask someone to produce an A-standard prose composition in the asphyxiating time frame of 1 hour? Tick-tock. Quietly and privately begging for divine intervention, I look at the creative prompts once again. 1. Magical moments from my childhood. Oh God is my immediate response. I'm not entirely sure I even have any of those. I could use that family holiday to Washington, D.C. a few years ago, but the details are only coming to me through the obscuring fog of memory, and personal essays of such a manner require crystal clear descriptions. Perhaps I could take the angle of Christmas as a child. After all, it is the most magical time of the year, especially for children. Not to mention there's so much to write about, the decorations, the songs, the presents, Santa Claus, etc. Perfect. I put my pen to paper, excitement stirring. I'm ready to make some creative ink stains, but then suddenly my pen is the correcting pen and I the examiner. I can't help but feel the bland, standard texture of the essay. The sweet flavour of inspiration turns bitter in my mouth. Tick-tock. Right, I think. Thinly veiled panic quickly building. Moving on. Number 2. My secret life as a superhero. Interesting. Perhaps some short story about how the daily good deed of the average citizen is the true moral glue that holds society together. It has potential, but it's been explored many times before, often in the context of a children's story. I immediately disregard the option of taking a literal interpretation of the title and weaving a ridiculous and pointless tale of superpowers and good versus evil. Tick-tock. Time is slipping away now, like sand, or perhaps smoke is a better simile. Either way, there isn't a single second to waste observing useless things like the dust that is dancing slowly in the sunbeams above me, or the strange glossy pineapple earrings of the person sitting next to me, or how the rhythmic clacking of the supervisor's high heels, the incessant clicking of pens and the relentless ticking of the clock all create a piercing cacophony of discord. Not a single precious second to waste on that monstrous shadow undulating in the light on the ground. I look up to the window to find its source, but all I see is a delicate little butterfly flapping its silent, pale green wings. I'd give anything to take its place outside in the cool, relaxed air, to escape the smothering atmosphere of the exam hall. Thank God I don't waste precious exam time observing such useless things. Tick-tock. Who's next? I ponder in insane cheerfulness, having lost all hope of ever actually writing anything. Number 4. Write a prose composition including the line, "That really was the last straw." I think you may be right, I think to myself, in exasperation. But it's too late and useless ideas come swirling into my brain. I could write about a man who's played second fiddle all his life to his family, his friends, and his boss. Perhaps I could tell the story of the day when everything went especially bad for him. I could describe all of the bad things that happened to him on that day, all culminating in the moment when a fellow employee snatches the last straw from him at the canteen in the office complex where he worked. After all, that would be the last straw both literally and figuratively. I begin to think it could work, but then suddenly that train of thought goes straight off the tracks and meets a fiery demise, when I realize I have absolutely no idea where to take this story from there. Tick-tock. Perhaps instead a short story about a parent who struggles to deal with the challenges of raising a teenager. There's bound to be a lot of frustration there. But I have a distinct lack of experience when it comes to raising teenagers, and I'm already starting to dislike the idea. I grind my teeth in frustration and try to resist the urge to raise my hand, ask for permission to go to the bathroom, and flush the exam down the toilet. Tick-tock. I force myself not to cast all hope into the abyss. Cautiously, I read the next prompt. Number 5. Write a speech for or against the motion, "Mobile phones should be banned in schools." Aren't they, I wonder, hopelessly confused? The appearance of a speech is certainly a breath of fresh poison at least. Something different. Yet unfortunately, speeches require one to be infallibly logical, and to come up with numerous valid arguments, and in my current state, that seems rather unlikely. Not to mention that I don't even understand the motion. I thought mobile phones were generally banned in schools to avoid distractions. Unless, of course, the motion refers to a prohibition on so much as having a mobile phone on one's person while on school grounds. Either way, I'm too flustered to think clearly. It's a lost cause. Tick-tock. Next up is number 6, The Rudest Person I've Ever Met. I certainly have a long list of nominations for that title. A large number of family members spring to mind. I could easily write a 3-page personal essay containing a long list of complaints about my family. But everyone has annoying family members, so who cares? What makes my case special? But perhaps a story about an employee overcoming the obstacles of working under an obnoxious, disrespectful boss. No, I've been through that idea already. Besides, it's too boring and I don't know anything about ordinary office jobs. TikTok. The next option suggests that I draw inspiration from a picture of a person running beneath a raincoat and a grey sky in a muddy field with a pink and blue tent. A music festival? Perhaps something terrible happens, like the stage collapses. Perhaps someone gets seriously injured. Perhaps someone even dies. Yet somehow it just seems so boring and unoriginal. I highly doubt I could write enough about it anyway. I've never even been to a music festival, and my imagination is running out. Almost as quickly as time. TikTok. I'm just preparing to have a little breakdown when I notice that one of the sentences has an unfamiliar shape to it. It's number 3. I had skipped it. What useless inspiration would it offer up? Why bother, I think irritably. It won't be any better than the others. I reflect for a moment on the time of my life, about 37 minutes ago according to the clock, when I was full of patience and hope. I wonder if I should leave the exam in the interest of student safety, but curiosity defeats me and I feel my eyes tentatively swing towards the essay title. Number 3, A Guide to Staying Calm. My hand ceases its constant twitching and my pen freezes. A small smile creeps across my face. I know exactly what to write about. TikTok.
We could all learn from that story. We'll go for our last poems of the programme, with this one from Publiskul Nasan. Last Night Wish, by Syed Edbury. Green scared eyes opened, drops of sweat platted his face. Ghostly pale, skinny bones, looking around in distaste. Moonbeams blinded his right side, but the rain covered the windowsill. Violet blue sky, few clouds in sight, thinking, please, one more night. Beeps from the life machine, only sound other than struggle breathing. Beeps slow each minute, eyelids sag each second. Knowing his wish didn't come true, they never did. Slowly laying down, beeps stop, no more sound. Lay down the dying boy. And our last poem is on an issue that affects most people at some time in their lives. She looked in his eyes and saw something special. He looked at her and only saw something beneficial. Her feelings grew strong, she fell hard for him, but little did she know that he was gonna cause her pain and sin. He promised he wouldn't forget her, he promised she wouldn't be left behind, but as usual, she was tossed to the side. She tried getting over her emotions in a negative way, but her friend had way too much to say. She said it was wrong, and that she would end up hurt. She didn't care, as her justification was blurred. He was gone, probably wasn't gonna come back. With all her emotions, she started to attack. But oh well, it was just a crush. She will go through more. And just like that, he walked out the door.
That's our poems for another week.
So ladies and gentlemen, our feature story today, I Was Going to Do It No Matter What, is written by Niamh Kelly, a pupil at Holy Faith Colchester.
I Was Going to Do It No Matter What by Niamh Kelly. It was the 1st of September. I was about to start my final year in high school. I was so full of different emotions. Excited I get to see all my friends and hear about what their summers were like. Sad because I had to go back to school and listen to teachers and overhear about how one girl hated her best friend and talked about her behind her back but acted on fake and nice to her face. Depressed that that was going to be my last first day of high school. Also overjoyed that this was going to be my last first day of high school and soon I'd be studying something I loved. I wanted to study law in one of the Ivy League colleges such as Brown or Harvard. I knew it was going to be hard to get where I wanted, but I was going to do it no matter what. See, I'm not from the best of areas or states, and most people in my school or my area just finish school and usually get married to one of their high school sweethearts and settle down and have their kids, and their wife just stays at home all day while their husband goes to work, which is fine for some people, and I'm 100% not judging them, it's just not the life I wanted. Sure, I'd love to have kids one day and a husband of my own, but I wanted to work and travel and finish my degree before all this, so that one day I can tell my kids about how I broke the cycle in my family. My mother followed this cycle, and then my older sister, Emma. I don't ever really see eye to eye with them, as they think I'm a bit mad or weird for wanting to do something different. Also, my mother and father didn't want me to go to college as it was too expensive, yet I told them I would take up a part-time job and take out a loan to help them pay. though my mother always said, sure, what would you need college for when your husband will be doing the work for you? And when she said this, I just rolled my eyes and looked at her blankly, because the truth is, I really couldn't care what anyone else thinks about what I want to do, because at the end of the day, it's my life, not theirs. And they'll be sorry one day when I'm doing something I love while they're not. My father, on the other hand, is a man of few words. His routine is wake up, eat, go to work, eat, come home, eat, and watch TV while my mother nagged at him about something. Sometimes have a cup of tea and lastly go to bed and start it all over the next day. Or at least this was his routine until one day on a midsummer's afternoon over dinner, he told my mother that he wanted a divorce. Not because he didn't love her anymore or because he wasn't happy like he was when he was 22 and newlywed. My mother didn't cry at this or shout, she just acted as if she didn't hear him and went on with the last conversation before he had interrupted her. I know she was hurt though, and I did feel for it since he had moved out. She hadn't said much and it was really affecting life for me and my other siblings. I've become both mother and father to them, as well as my mother. Even though my father sees us a lot since he has left, it's just not the same. This has taken a lot of time away from my own life of my studies and was causing me to fail one or two classes. Yet some of the teachers didn't help and didn't make me feel like I was worth anything. For example, my maths teacher told me I was no good and wouldn't make it in life if I didn't do well in this subject, and starting to ignore me in classes. Eventually I gave up on him and started teaching myself the subject, and boy did I show him what I was really made of when I got my results and passed. I feel like I was worth something again, and life got easier, and my mother got happy, got a job and was no longer nagging. She and my father were getting along better and knew their divorce was best for them and the family. Though I passed the subject, I didn't get enough to go into one of the Ivy League colleges straight away. I did, however, get there in the end with doing some different courses until I felt my course teachers and my results said I was ready. These courses gave me a lot of insight into what type of law I wanted to study. I picked family law, as I would like to help families to get justice and get them the help they deserve and need. I am currently in Harvard studying this, and I am in my final year. This has just reminded me of what I went through and the hard work I did to get where I am today, which reminded me of my final year in high school.
What an incredible program. But unfortunately, that's all we have for you today. I hope we got to your story or poem. If we didn't, there's always next week.
Don't forget to check out the Tales from the Dark Pool Facebook page and the Near FM website for full details on the series. You can download a podcast of this program.
We hope you enjoyed today's show.
And will join us at the same time next week on Tales from the Dark Pool broadcast here on Near FM.
Today's Tales from the Dark Pool program was produced by Enda M. Roach and is a Perlman Media production for Near FM.
So from myself, Sarah Challoner.
And myself, Lala Raymond.
Until next week, slán go fóill.